Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, how the pandemic has led to an explosion of union activity, and humans might not like the spotted lantern fly, but honeybees do. We'll tell you why. But first, what a weekend for Philly sports fans. Phillies beat the Braves in four games to punch their ticket to the National League Championship Series for the first time since 2010. They now head to San Diego, and the Eagles remain undefeated in a heart-thumping 26-17 win over the Cowboys last night. They are now 6-0. Philadelphia Inquirer sports columnist Mike Sielski is here to talk about all of us. And Mike, I should also mention you are author of The Rise, Kobe Bryant and the Pursuit of Immortality. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Mary. Always a pleasure.
Well, it's a lot of fun today, isn't it? It's almost like Christmas. I'm not sure which story to unpack first, but
It's remarkable. It's an amazing time in the city for its sports teams.
Let's go to the Eagles. Since they played last night, were you expecting a 6-0 start for this Eagles team?
I wasn't expecting a 6-0 start, but I did expect them to be pretty good. One of the things that they were able to do in the offseason, because the NFL is a salary cap league and because their quarterback, Jalen Hurts, to be quite frank, isn't making a whole lot of money. He's still on his rookie contract. The Eagles were able to build a roster of very talented players around Hurts because they're able to pay those players more money under the cap. And what you've got now is a very well-rounded team that can beat its opponents in a lot of different ways. And they're going to be a force to be reckoned with as the season moves on. They've got the bye week now. They get some rest. And then they've got a stretch of games where they're going to be favored in virtually every one.
Wow. Hurts looks good this year, don't you think?
He does. They run a kind of unique offense around him. It's actually more suited to, or used more, I should say, by college teams, particularly the University of Oklahoma, where Hurts played his last season of college ball. It relies on a lot of what are called run-pass options, which basically rely on Jalen Hurts to make a decision whether he's going to hand the ball off to a running back or pass it or run it with it himself. And it's very confusing to defenses. It takes advantage of his skills in a big way. And he has a lot more skilled and talented players to throw the ball to or to hand the ball off to. It's all coming together for the Eagles right now.
Still, you know, last night wasn't entirely a cakewalk. The Eagles with a 20-0 lead in the first half, but then fans were biting their nails in the third quarter. What was happening, Mike?
Well, a couple of things. Number one, late in the first half, the Eagles lost Lane Johnson, their right tackle. And the absolute clear-cut strength of the Eagles is their offensive line. It's the best and the deepest in the entire league. And Lane Johnson's probably the best right tackle in the league. And once he left, I think it took a little while for the offense to get its bearings back. The other thing is, you know, the Cowboys are very good defensively. They were able to shut the Eagles down at least for a little while there. And the Cowboys changed their strategy offensively and were able to get some things going. There was a big kickoff return late in the first half that got the momentum back on the Cowboys side. But Cooper Rush, the Cowboys quarterback last night, is their backup. He's not very good. He's not very experienced. And so the Eagles were kind of able to take advantage of that and as you said, kind of eke out the victory.
Yeah. Bye week, as you mentioned, next week. How can this affect momentum?
Well, I think it helps the Eagles in a way because it does give them a rest. It gives Johnson in particular time to recover the Eagles hope from his concussion. Now, obviously, his health has to be the number one priority, but when you're thinking about a team's fortunes, you have to think about whether your best offensive lineman is going to be available. But yeah, look, they're going to go a little bit of time here where they don't get a break coming off of the bye. So it's going to be important for them to hit the ground running. But as I said, you know, you look at their schedule and it's pretty favorable. There aren't a lot of games against teams where you say, oh, you know, that opponent is going to give the Eagles a run for their money. The Eagles should be favored in virtually every game they play from here on out.
Terrific. All right. Well, let's get to the Phillies. I'll ask you the same question that I asked about the Eagles. Did you think this Phillies team would best the defending World Series champs, the Braves, in four games?
Well, I will say, Mary, I picked them before the season, the series began, to win in five games.
Why?
That's not to say that the Braves weren't a better team during the regular season, but the Phillies have some qualities that are enhanced and are very advantageous in a short playoff series. One of them is that they have two terrific starting pitchers in Zach Wheeler and Aaron Nola, and either of those guys can beat any other pitcher in baseball on any other day. So if they're pitching well, and both of them are, that gives the Phillies a great chance to win. The other thing is the Phillies have the kind of lineup that has several players who can hit the ball out of the ballpark, who are very dynamic offensively, and they don't need all of them hitting well at the same time for them to produce runs. And we've been seeing that to a certain degree. For instance, Kyle Schwarber, their leadoff hitter, led the National League in home runs this season. He really hasn't hit since the postseason began, but they're getting terrific hitting from Bryce Harper. Rhys Hoskins, of course, has had a couple, you know, big hits, that big home run in game three, another RBI single in game four. And they're getting contributions from other guys throughout the lineup. So in a short playoff series, you know, you don't need to play well every single day for 162 games. You just need to play well and pitch well for a few games at a time, and the Phillies are very capable of that.
Yeah, it's all coming together for them right now because they literally just snuck into the postseason. They clinched the final postseason berth.
Yeah, they only had 87 wins during the regular season out of 162 games. They had the worst, so to speak, record of the six National League teams that made the postseason. But if you look around baseball right now, this is what's been happening throughout the playoffs is because of the nature of the postseason, because the wild cards are a best of three series and the divisional round are a best of five, you're seeing teams like the Los Angeles Dodgers and the Braves getting knocked out early in the playoffs just because the postseason becomes so unpredictable because it's so short.
Yeah, you mentioned Aaron Nola just a few moments ago. A fun side story to the Phillies Padres series coming up, Nola versus Nola. Well, in a way.
Yeah. Yes, his brother Austin plays for the Padres, and it's going to be an interesting series for a lot of reasons. You know, the same offseason that the Phillies signed Bryce Harper, they were also interested in a player named Manny Machado. Those two were kind of the top free agent targets for all of the teams in Major League Baseball, two superstar hitters. And Machado, of course, ended up signing with the Padres. So you've got two of the premier players in Major League Baseball kind of facing off against each other. It's an interesting storyline there. The Padres are a similar team to the Phillies in that they were a wild card team. They were not the best team in their division. Mm-hmm. And yet here they both are in the championship series.
Yeah, they stunned the Dodgers. Do the Phils, do they have their work cut out for them for this series?
Well, I think you always have your work cut out for you in any postseason series. But I think if you shot each Phillies player and manager and coach up with sodium pentothal and asked them, would you rather play the Padres or the Dodgers in the National League Championship Series? I think to a man, they would say the Padres. Nothing against San Diego, but the Dodgers were an absolute juggernaut during the regular season and just happened to get bounced in the divisional series.
Mike, do you want to go out on a limb and give us a little prognostication about how this series ends up working out?
Maybe I'm biased here, Mary. Maybe this is proximity bias or recency bias or whatever. I think the Phillies win this series in six games. I like the top of their starting rotation, as we talked about, Aaron Nola and Zach Wheeler. Just as importantly, they have some relievers now in guys like Sir Anthony Dominguez and Zach Eflin, who are able, and particularly Jose Alvarado, who are able to strike out opposing hitters late in a game. And that is absolutely vital. If you can prevent the opposing team from even putting the ball in play very often in the seventh, eighth, and ninth innings, that's a huge advantage to your team, and the Phillies have that in their bullpen.
Yeah. All right. Phillies in six. We like the bias, Mike. We'll take it.
I try to be objective most of the time, but it's hard not to get swept up in what's been going on these last few days, Mary.
Sure. Absolutely. All right. On to a couple other questions. The Flyers, no one expects much from them this season, Mike, but they won their first two games out of the gate. Coach John Tortorella has said, we don't have a lot of big names. It's not a terribly skilled team. We're going to have to do it as a team, and that means a belief in how we back one another up. Is Philly fever catching here?
Well, I think what you're seeing in this situation, Mary, is that John Tortorella is a very intense, hard-driving coach. And so it's not all that surprising that the Flyers would begin their season and come out of the gate playing really hard and pretty well for him. But as he said and acknowledged, this is not a team with a lot of top-end talent. It's going to have to win the games that it wins by just outworking and out-toughing its opponents. And over the course of an 82-game regular season in the National Hockey League, that's only going to get you so far. So it's terrific that they've gotten off to this start. It's encouraging that they're playing this hard for Tortorella. But I think over the course of a full season, you know, reality will out, so to speak. And I think the Flyers will struggle to make the playoffs. Yeah.
Sixers opener is this week. They're in Boston tomorrow night. How does the upcoming campaign look there?
They should be a favorite to win the Eastern Conference and get to the NBA Finals. You know, Joel Embiid is a premier player in the NBA. I think everybody who even follows the Sixers casually knows that. Tyrese Maxey, their young guard, has become as popular an athlete, a professional athlete in this city as anyone, just with his skills and ability and his personality and effervescence. But the key to this season to me is James Harden. You know, the superstar that they acquired at the end of last season, he wasn't quite what they hoped he would be in the playoffs, particularly in that second round loss to the Miami Heat. He's 33. He's making a lot of money, though he did kind of take a quasi pay cut heading into this season so that they could add more players under the salary cap. Harden to me is the key to this. If he's not an elite complement to Joel Embiid, the Sixers are not going to get to where they want to be.
All right. And one more big Philly sports note here. The Union host FC Cincinnati in the Major League Soccer playoffs, Eastern Conference semifinals. This Thursday, the boys in blue are the number one seed there. So the fun continues. One more question for you, Mike. Back to the Phillies. Mm-hmm. Manager Rob Thomson, finally named manager as opposed to interim manager. What has he done that Joe Girardi could not do with this club?
He has created a favorable work environment for this team. The line I've been using about Joe Girardi, who I covered back when I was working in New York and he was managing the Yankees, was that if you handed him a lump of coal, he would squeeze it into a diamond in his fist by the end of a conversation with him. And what Rob Thomson has lent the Phillies is just a measure of calmness and relaxation that I think this team needed. Everybody wants a favorable and productive working environment. And Girardi, I think, kind of cultivated this kind of tension around the team. He kind of radiated it. And Thomson doesn't. You know, Thomson is able to relate to veterans and younger players and just creates this kind of environment where guys feel free to be themselves, to play hard, to be professionals. And I think it's worked wonders for this team.
Yeah. And when you see where they are right now, we're just glad, you know, all of us fans that that he's been named manager. So, OK, great time to be a Phillies fan. Mike Sielski, as always, so nice to have you with us. Thanks so much. And we'll stay in touch.
My pleasure, Mary. Thank you.
Mike Sielski is sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer and author of The Rise, Kobe Bryant and the Pursuit of Immortality. Up next on the Regional Roundup, we talk about the surge in labor organizing and rally cries for workers' rights with Rebecca Given, labor studies professor at Rutgers University. Also, the new Art Museum union contract. Lots of news. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As the Philadelphia Museum of Art prepares to open its much-anticipated Matisse exhibit on Thursday, striking museum workers have ratified their first union contract after 3 full weeks of walking the picket line. They are back to work now. At the same time, nurses and other hospital employees at Temple University Hospital have voted to authorize a strike. And stories of workers attempting to organize at giant employers like Starbucks and Amazon continue to headline the news cycle. There's been a notable uptick in union activity in recent years across a variety of sectors, led in many cases by members of younger generations. So we thought we'd spend some time this hour examining the evolving workplace, what employees are asking for, and the changing trajectory of the labor movement. Also, full disclosure, WHYY employees are represented by two unions, IBEW Local 98 and SAG-AFTRA. Rebecca Given is Associate Professor of Labor Studies at Rutgers University and President of the Rutgers Faculty and Graduate Labor Union. Welcome to the Regional Roundup, Rebecca.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin, with the local news. The Art Museum is busy preparing the Matisse in the 1930s exhibition, a huge event. Philly's the only museum in the country to host this exhibit. And this is all happening as museum employees and management, seemingly in the nick of time, came to terms on the first union contract for workers at the museum. Rebecca, if the walkout had continued into its fourth week this week and collided with the Matisse exhibit, it would have been a tough situation at one of Philadelphia's cultural jewels. What's your take on the weekend's developments?
I think that these moments of, for example, a high-profile exhibit opening really provide maximum leverage. The museum management does not want to deal with workers walking picket lines with the support of local community members, local political leaders, while those who might otherwise be visiting the museum have to decide whether to stay away or, you know, consider crossing a picket line. So the leverage is really high for the workers. It's really a moment to settle the dispute and reach an agreement. So those moments of real leverage where the disruption can be maximized by workers withdrawing their labor often sort of focus the minds at the bargaining table and allow that agreement to be reached. And that's what happened here.
All right. I'd like to bring Adam Rizzo into the conversation. He is Philadelphia Museum of Art Union President. Welcome, Adam, to the Regional Roundup.
Thank you for having me.
Employees are heading back to work. Tell us about the organizing effort and your thoughts on the new contract.
Well, I'll start with the new contract. I think we're all really thrilled that with what we were able to achieve. We didn't expect to be out on strike for, you know, as long as we were. It was 19 days out on the picket line.
Yeah.
But we held really strong as a group, and I think we bonded as a community in ways that I couldn't have anticipated, which was really beautiful. But I think, you know, the most important thing is that we were able to achieve all of the goals that we set out to achieve in this first contract, which includes things like, you know, 4 weeks of paid parental leave. Previously, we had zero across the board raises over the course of the 3-year contract in 14%. Longevity increases and making healthcare more affordable at the museum for our employees. So I think it's true that, you know, this Matisse exhibition put a lot of pressure on the museum to kind of settle up this contract. And we also had so much support from, like, the community, other union siblings around Philadelphia, and also just, you know, the local politicians at the mayor's office who really put a lot of pressure on for us to get this done.
It took a long time to get this done. The negotiations lasted how long, Adam?
So we've been negotiating our first contract for more than 2 years. I will say that throughout this process, the museum, or at least management, really were kind of digging their heels in on even, like, non-economic issues. And I think that speaks to the representation that they chose to have at the bargaining table. They hired lawyers from Morgan, Lewis, and Bacchius to represent them at the bargaining table and negotiate with us. And, you know, I think that sent a clear signal early on by hiring a union avoidance law firm that we were in it for, there was going to be quite a fight.
Yeah.
I'm just super proud of what we accomplished.
So one more question for you, Adam. How might this new agreement make the museum a better experience for visitors?
Well, I think one huge problem that I've experienced at the museum in my 8 years there is how much turnover there is and how many staff end up leaving for better opportunities at other institutions. And then there's just so much institutional knowledge lost when that happens. There can be like a real brain drain that happens. And, you know, I think it will, the contract will provide more stability and security for workers. And that can only make a visitor's experience better. So I think that's really important to hold on to.
Adam Rizzo, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Adam is head of the Philadelphia Museum of Art Union. And we do have a statement from the Philadelphia Museum of Art. The statement says, "We are pleased to have been able to work with the union and the city of Philadelphia to reach a strong agreement that works for everyone. We were able to come to this agreement after receiving significant support from the city, Mayor Jim Kenney, and the deputy mayor. We believe that the staff of the PMA is the foundation of the museum's future." Rebecca Given, back to you. Let's talk about the use of a walkout, a strike, as a tool. It's always been the big tool out of the toolbox in the, what, many, many years of union history in this country. In 2022, it's still the ultimate weapon?
Yeah, it's absolutely the ultimate weapon. It's not the it's not the only thing workers can do, but it is the biggest thing they can do. It provides the most leverage. Without the workers, the organization, the company, the nonprofit, the hospital can't function, can't do anything. And it's absolutely the biggest thing that workers can do, but it's also the culmination of sort of individual transformations where workers realize that they don't only depend on their boss for a paycheck, but their bosses depend on them. And that sort of transformative process, which you can see play out when you see something like the museum workers go from their early organizing conversations to forming a union, winning a union election, and then winning a first contract, you see that that understanding that workers start to achieve, that they actually do have the ability to withdraw their labor.
Nurses and other hospital workers at Temple University Hospital have authorized a strike. They haven't gone out yet, but how might a strike authorization move negotiations forward?
A strike authorization is sort of the, I guess, the penultimate step, you could say, if the strike is the ultimate act, where workers show that they are really serious and they're ready to take action. Usually when a union calls a strike authorization vote, they're looking for a really, really strong show of commitment. You're not going to go ahead and walk out on strike if support has been sort of barely majority support. You're looking at, you know, 90% or more worker support for walking out on strike, because you want to be sure that everybody feels strongly enough. Striking is hard. It involves a loss of income. Sure. It involves very, very, you know, challenging conversations and decisions. And workers are only going to walk out on strike if they feel that collectively that's something that they really want to do, and that there's absolutely strong support. So the strike authorization sends a message to management that, you know, this is really your last chance. The strike threat is real. It's credible, and we're willing to do it. We don't want to do it, but we'll do it if that's what we need to do.
There has been an uptick in organization across different sectors of the economy. And again, we're seeing headlines, you know, Starbucks and Amazon and efforts at the various facilities associated with those giant companies. First of all, why are we seeing more organization in 2022?
Yeah, I think a few factors are coming together. I think sort of coming through the pandemic, many workers realized how little their bosses cared about them. So many workers felt like health and safety wasn't taken seriously. Through the sort of darkest days of the pandemic, they felt like their bosses didn't really care if they lived or died. And in many cases, these companies were making a lot of money while sort of jeopardizing the well-being of their employees. And so that really, I think, made workers ready to take action. But we're also seeing a very, very tight labor market. Yeah. And usually workers are somewhat afraid to organize because they know that they may be risking losing their job. It's illegal to fire someone for organizing a union, but the reality is it happens all the time, even though it's illegal.
Yeah.
But when you feel like if you lose your job, you could walk outside and get another job immediately, that's nowhere near as scary as times when jobs are hard to come by. So workers are, I think, emboldened to stay, to try to improve their workplace and to take action together with their coworkers, because the threat of losing your job is not as bad as when the labor market looks very different.
If there is not another job to go to, an employee feels they've lost their job because they're taking part in organization, what recourse might they have?
The recourse they have is to bring what's called unfair labor practice charges, but charges to the National Labor Relations Board, which is the agency that covers most private sector workers. The problem is that the agency is underfunded. It works very slowly. So you may, for example, be reinstated to your job, but it could take several months. In some cases, it takes years. And from the employer perspective, it's not much of a deterrent because you would be ordered to reinstate that worker, possibly give them back pay for the time they were out, but no bigger penalty than that. So there's not a penalty sort of proportional with the size of the company or how much profit it's making that acts as sort of a fine or a real punishment. And because of that, these laws that are laws on the books are quite weak because they don't have any enforcement teeth.
Is the increase in union organizing a generational movement, do you think? Seems like there are a lot of young faces attached to organization
efforts. It's too soon to tell numerically. The loss of union membership over time has been quite dramatic, and so we'll see if these new organizing attempts can undo some of the losses in recent years. But what we're seeing is young workers are organizing. So many of these new organizing drives at Starbucks, at independent coffee shops, at retail outlets, at museums, cultural institutions, nonprofits, they're led by young workers, often workers in their 20s, often workers who have come up in an environment where they feel like it's the right thing to do to speak out for justice, for fairness, on behalf of their coworkers, if not themselves. And they're also really wanting to hold their employers accountable for their rhetoric. So many of these employers speak very sort of appealingly about things like social justice, whether it's support for Black Lives Matter or for queer and trans employees. They say kind of all the right things, but their actions don't really match their rhetoric. And these young workers are really willing to speak up and say, you don't get to say that and get credit for that unless your actions are going to follow through on your rhetoric.
Fascinating. You are listening to WHYY in Philadelphia. Our guest is Rebecca Given, Associate Professor of Labor Studies at Rutgers University and President of the Rutgers Faculty and Graduate Labor Union. Rebecca, tell us about the so-called progressive veneer that some workplaces adopt and how this can actually help to hold employers accountable for their actions.
Yeah, so certain employers really put forward sort of progressive, socially responsible image. And it's often a brand that they're promoting both to possible employees and to customers. So whether we're talking about being more pro-environment, whether we're talking about the kind of benefits they offer to employees, so offering something like gender-affirming care. We see these companies from Apple to Starbucks to REI who are sort of saying that they're doing the right thing. And they often attract employees who want that an employer. They want a better employer. They're setting themselves apart from companies like, let's say, Amazon and Walmart. And workers find that appealing. And when they get there and they feel exploited and taken advantage of, they're often really willing to take action. So we see, for example, at Starbucks, Starbucks has really promoted itself as an employer that's a safe space, for example, for young, queer, and trans workers. And when they get there, they're often, as you can imagine, tightly bonded to each other. They feel they have a lot in common. And when they feel that they're mistreated by their employer, they feel sort of more betrayed than if the employer had never had that progressive veneer in the first place, had never said all those things or made those surface level commitments. And that often spurs them to take action. We often say the boss is the best organizer because the boss's actions are really a lot of the time what leads the workers to organize. So not living up to your stated progressive values is a really good way to get workers to say enough is enough, we're gonna unionize.
Interesting. Has the current political climate played a significant part in the increase in union organization?
I think it has in some ways. I think, for example, a lot of the workers who are organizing now have come out of different kinds of organizations and social movements that have made them think about organizing and the power of collective action. So we see not so much now with Occupy because, you know, that was over a decade ago, and those are no longer the younger workers. But certainly people who were engaged, for example, in the Bernie Sanders campaign had their first understanding of organizing and labor organizing specifically because that election campaign was so closely linked to what people can do at work. And I also think there are many, many people getting involved in, for example, the Democratic Socialists of America, where conversations about organizing with your coworkers are really frequent. And so people are starting to understand not just that you can organize, but how to organize and what are the tools you need to organize.
So Rebecca, given we've got about a minute left, what does it take to start a union chapter? What's the procedure like? Step one.
The first thing is to talk to your coworkers. Just talking to coworkers is how all successful organizing drives happen. There are many resources out there to figure out if you want to affiliate with an existing union or start your own independent union. But the biggest thing is just talking to coworkers about your experience at work, what you could improve if you had a voice on the job, what you are missing out on by not having the protection of a union, and having those conversations, bringing things out into the open, shining light on the issues in the workplace, whether it's, you know, racism and sexism, whether it's favoritism, whether it's, you know, pay that's not a living wage. Starting to have those conversations together is really very, very basic, but it's the only way to start organizing a union.
Well, thank you so much, Rebecca Given. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Rebecca Given is Associate Professor of Labor Studies at Rutgers University and President of the Rutgers Faculty and Graduate Labor Union. Up next on the Regional Roundup, when life gives you lantern flies, make honey. Don Shump, founder of the Philadelphia Bee Company, will be along to explain. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. This is the time of year in which spotted lanternflies begin to reproduce. And as always, officials are urging us to destroy the grayish or cream-colored egg masses. But we'll likely have to live with at least some lanternfly population. And in a stroke of luck, many local beekeepers have discovered a way to make lemonade out of lemons, so to speak. More accurately, their bees have begun to produce a honey-like product out of spotted lanternfly honeydew, a secretion notorious for its ability to coat everything around heavily infested trees. And despite what many of us might consider to be the ick factor, people are buying this honeydew honey. Don Shump is the owner and founder of the Philadelphia Bee Company, and he's here with us in studio for the rest of the hour. Don, great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Full disclosure, I tried some of this honeydew honey, and I found it, it was okay. I mean, I liked it.
It's kind of shocking how good it is. It's one of those where people aren't really sure what to make of it. But, you know, it's a fall honey with a little something extra.
I found a hint of molasses.
Mm-hmm. That sounds about right.
Yeah. But it took a while for me to actually put that little testing spoon to my mouth. We'll get into that in just a moment. You know, the whole kind of aura around this substance. But first, when did you become aware that your honeybees had discovered something other than the usual flower?
So this was back in 2019, and part of what my business does is we do honeybee removal. So if you get bees in your house, we're the people you call to get those out. And we had done a removal, and we were processing the comb out. And I walked into my honey house and kind of looked at my guys and said, "Who's eating maple bacon in here?" Because that's what it smelled like. Mm. And that's a no-no. You don't do that. Yeah. My guys looked at me and said, "Don, it's not us. It's the honey." I said, "Come off it." And so I gave it a taste, and I was like, "I don't know what this is." And so it kind of had like a smoky profile to it, like a little bit of a meaty tang on the thin. And I was like, "I've never tasted that." Normally, you have some idea, yeah. But in this case, it's like we had no clue. And so I had called up the state inspector, Jeff Eckel. He runs InStar Apiary. He's a good guy. And I said, Jeff, you know, I got the situation. He said, let me guess. He said, you've got weird honey. And I was like,
weird
yeah.
honey.
And so like here, like, you know, all the beekeepers in southeastern Pennsylvania were kind of in a panic over it because nothing had changed botanically. And so we had no idea what was going on. And he said, send the samples to Penn State and, you know, we'll get this sorted out. And Penn State got back to us and said, yeah, it's perfectly safe to eat. But it tested positive for lanternfly DNA and allanthone, which is a chemical compound only found in the tree of heaven and only in the sap. And so the only way the bees could get access to this is through the lanternfly.
Okay. And lanternflies love the tree of heaven. It's one of their favorite.
That's right.
Favorite targets.
Yeah, the adult stage of the lanternfly, yeah. That's what they predate on almost exclusively.
So tell us about spotted lanternfly honeydew and why the bees are so attracted to it.
So what happens is that the bees kind of go for whatever nectar source is most readily available. And typically that's, you know, flowers. The lanternfly are producing honeydew at a time of year where there's not much else going on in terms of, you know, the flowers that are available. And so in those cases, the bees will, you know, pick up whatever sugary sources they can find. Sometimes those aren't natural, like it's the case with the Maraschino Cherry Factory in New York.
What happened there?
So the beekeepers were harvesting their honey, and it came out looking and tasting like Robitussin. And so it was this bright fluorescent red, and everybody was like, what was going on? And here the bees had gotten into the off spill from a Maraschino Cherry Factory. And this had happened, I believe it was in 2012 in France, where it was the bees were pulling out green, blue, brown, orange, red honey, M&M factory.
You're kidding.
And so the bees will get long way around the bend. The bees will get into things that are not from flowers. And in this case, the lanternfly, part of how they're destructive is the honeydew falls on the lower canopy and it can smother the plants below. And so the bees can pick that up and bring it back to the hive and dehydrate it down like any other nectar source.
Does it actually help when the bees do this?
Do they pick enough of it up? Yeah, I mean, they probably don't do enough of it to stop the lanternfly from being destructive. You know, certainly, you know, it's not helping the actual predation on the trees themselves, but it doesn't hurt.
So do we call this an actual honey? I've seen different, you know, naming, you know, I've seen different words for it.
Yeah. So
honeydew, honey.
It's technically speaking, it's a honeydew. So honeydew is a non-floral nectar source. And these are common, and it's more common, I'd say, in Australia and Europe, but typically from aphids. And so in this case, we say it's a spotted lanternfly honey just to keep the conversation simple. People hear honeydew and they're thinking of the fruit.
Yeah.
You know, so that's we call it a honey just to avoid that confusion.
Or the icky stuff that they are now seeing, you know, on trees.
Correct.
So you actually, Don, took buckets of this stuff off of other beekeepers because they didn't want it.
Correct.
What were you thinking at the time? Did you see something big happening here?
So it was one of those things where it's like we didn't know initially. And so, you know, we had sent all these samples off to Penn State and they had reached out to the beekeepers and kind of said, well, you know, does anybody want this stuff? We have literal buckets of it. And a lot of the beekeepers in Pierre, you know, were a little more of a conservative bent and kind of said, that sounds a little weird. And, of course, I'm sitting there going, well, you know, I have bees above a candy store in Old City, Philadelphia. Like, you know, the weird we do. Yeah. And so, yeah, let me try a bucket. And so I took a jar of it down to a honey and cheese pairing we were doing at the main library. My cheesemonger, Alex Jones, was working with me there. And I gave her a jar and I said, what do you think of this? And she said, I know exactly what to do with that. And so she put it with the blue cheese. And it was like the hit of the night. And everybody
Why
was...
Why does that work?
So it's just one of those where it's more of a savory honey. Mm. And so like a lot of the fall honeys tend to lean that way anyways. And so it's kind of a dark where it's like, you know, early spring honey will be very floral and light. You know, something you'd be more apt to put in your tea. You know, blue cheese is a very strong cheese. Yeah. And so if you didn't have a strong honey flavor to kind of go with that... It would overpower it. So the two just worked really well. And then with the people's reaction, I called up Penn State the next day and I was like, I will buy all of that, please and thank you.
Well, let's get to that. I mean, it worked at the free library. So with your customer base coming into your outlet, I know my local apiary also sells this stuff. And mm-hmm. when I brought a jar into work, the reaction from my fellow employees was interesting. Some just said, no thanks, you know. Right. Some dove right in. and said it was either good or meh, you know, whatever. But it was interesting to see the reaction of people to spotted lanternfly honey or honeydew.
I think it's one of those, if you don't tell the people up front, they're more inclined to try it.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, by and large, you know, people seem to love it. We get a lot of return customers, you know, so it'd be one thing if it was just sort of novel and it's like, well, this is weird, but at least I can say I ate it. With this, it's not, you know, it's not that at all. It's like people buy it and they're like, oh my gosh, like I need more of this. Like, this is amazing.
I know somebody who cooks with it. She puts it in stir fry with her vegetables.
Yeah. The stir fry is good. I like it with the honey burger.
Honey burgers.
Yeah, you do 2 pounds of meat, half a jar, so it's about 4 ounces, and then soy sauce, cinnamon, chili powder. And then if you do the honeydew honey, then you put that with the blue cheese on a brioche bun. And I have to tell my kids, it's like, you can't have four of these. You have to reel it in a little bit.
Okay, well, we're getting some calls and comments into WHYY, or I should say Radio Times at WHYY.org, 888-477-9499. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Leo asks, does this mean those particular bees aren't making traditional honey?
No. And so the bees are going out and, you know, they'll tend to stay loyal to whatever nectar source they have available to them. Writ large, the bees will prefer flowers to the honeydew. A lot of these places where we're getting the honeydew honey is actually from areas that did not have a fall nectar flow prior to the introduction of the lanternfly. So these are areas where there was no honey coming in at all. And now the beekeepers are able to pack it in.
So because this is a spotted lanternfly, I mean, is there any risk to the honeybees?
No. Like, this is one where one of our initial concerns was, you know, would there be pesticides? Because people are actively trying to down the lanternfly. The answer is no. That's part of the reason why we got it sampled right out of the gates, is that, you know, beekeepers are very sensitive to this sort of thing. And so we sent off the samples to Penn State to make sure that it was safe. On the whole, if there was any poison in it, the bee likely wouldn't make it home anyway when they're harvesting it. Mm.
Don Shump, as a beekeeper, can you tell where our honey comes from, like which plants your honeybees are gathering nectar from?
To some degree, on the whole, like if you get, we'll get honey in at different times of years, and I'll kind of be able to deduce based on, you know, where the yard is, because we have hives in every section of the city. And so, like this year, for example, we had a honey come in from Fairmount Park where it was like almost a water white. Had a real, and that's the color designation. And so it was very light in color. And it happened just about the same time as when the black locust trees came into bloom. And so that was one where it's like just being able to kind of figure out, okay, the black locusts were real strong this year. And so that's likely what it is. You can guess, but, you know, to really say for certain, you actually have to do a pollen count and go in there and say, okay, there are this many grains of this kind of pollen. That's what they were hitting.
Well, when most of us think of beekeeping operations, I'm gathering that, you know, we don't normally think of something in a major urban area like Philadelphia. What are the challenges?
So a lot of guys, I mean, you know, it's traditionally you imagine like bees being set up in like a farmer's field and you can have like 500 colonies and, you know, in one spot. And then you roll up with your gear and everything's there and you're off to the races. For me, you know, my yards are broadly speaking between 5 and 20. You know, I'd say 10's about the average per apiary. It would take me 7 hours just to drive to my apiaries and wave at them, not even look at a bee. And so part of the challenge is just logistically getting from spot to spot. And then it's, you know, the issues of, you know, we don't have to deal with bears in the city, but, you know, you do have to deal with just trying to get to your yard. If it's up in a building and the business is closed or, you know, at one point we had a yard that was 14 stories up in the air. You know, if you forget a hive tool, well, you just tacked on another half hour to your day.
Yeah.
You know, so it's that kind of thing.
How did you get into this business?
Oh, goodness. I like to quip that I had a quarter-life crisis. I was a web developer in a former life. And so I had done that for 10 years and realized that I was, you know, I'm built to be a pack mule, so I was wasting my natural talents sitting in front of a computer watching my waistline and my blood pressure go up. But I took it up as a hobby. Like, you know, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. You know, I knew I was kind of, you know, done with the web development. And so I had volunteered at a community garden down in 3rd and 4th and Christian Street. And, you know, a woman there was Carolyn Scott, a 68-year-old retired physical therapist. And, you know, I rolled in all, you know, hey, I want to be a beekeeper. And she looked at me totally deadpan and said, you know, you're going to get stung, right? And so I was like, yes. And she said, good, you're in.
Well, that is part of the job.
Right. No, absolutely.
And is that intimidating?
Oh, well, the first, you know, the first time I went into the hives, she kind of looked at me and said, are you okay? And I said, yeah. And in my brain, I'm going, run, run. You should be running. Like, what are you doing?
Because how many bees are there?
Well, that's what I mean. Like, each hive averages 60,000.
Yikes.
And so, you know, as soon as you go in and hear it, the hairs start to stand on the back of your neck.
And you're protected.
Well, right. You know, we're wearing gear, but that doesn't matter, like, you know, in terms of your reaction. And so it took some time to really become accustomed to it. But, you know, I tell everybody you should stick your face into a hive full of stinging insects at least once in your life.
Gosh. Well, let me just take a moment to tell everybody that this is WHYY in Philadelphia. We are talking about it's spotted lanternfly honeydew or honey. Don Shump, the founder of the Philadelphia Bee Company, sells this stuff, and it's unique and it's interesting. And also, the job of being a beekeeper is fascinating. I mean, you've advanced in your career, Don, to where you do the bee beard.
Yes, absolutely.
Why?
this is one where I do the bee bearding for the Philadelphia Honey Festival, which is the weekend after Labor Day every year. And so the bee beard is to demonstrate to people just how docile bees can be. You know, honeybees get a bad rep writ large. And, you know, so it's one of those where and a lot of that's because people, you know, get stung by other things like yellow jackets, what have you. And so the bee beard is where, you know, I take a swarm of bees and then, you know, I put their queen in a cage and I tie her.
How do you do that first?
So it's about 3 days of prep. And so we'll go and I'll find a hive that's relatively mild mannered. And then a couple days before we're going to do the bee beard, I'll actually move the hive about 5 to 10 feet away. And the rule in beekeeping is you move a hive less than 10 feet or more than 2 miles. And so less than 2 feet, the bees will figure out where home is. If you move it more than that, then the field bees coming back will not know where home is. And so we'll leave another dummy hive to catch the field bees. Bees are old and cranky, and they have a propensity to sting. And so I really don't want to be wearing those. So the bees that are left predominantly are nurse bees, who are more, you know, amenable to being manipulated in that way. And so the next day I'll go into the hive, I'll cage up the queen. We have special cages in beekeeping to do that. And then I'll dump the worker bees into a box with her. We have little wooden boxes with screen sides called packages. And we'll feed them a lot. And so bees that are well fed tend to be happier. And so I'm, as someone who gets hangry, that's, you know, I understand this. And so the next day I'll take the queen out and I'll just take shoelaces and tie her to my chin. And then we unceremoniously dump the bees onto my chest. And the queen's pheromone is what attracts them. And so they're in a swarm mode now. Like, they don't have a hive to defend. And, you know, so they're just trying to figure out, okay, where's the queen? Like, we got to get together and hang out.
Then
people can come and feed them. It's really neat. It's something to behold for sure.
And we've got to wrap up here in a few seconds, but what does that feel like on your
It's kind of like, it's the most ridiculous nano massage you could possibly imagine. Like the bees, it's almost like if you could imagine what it would feel like to be a piece of Velcro. That's what it's like.
And you kind of reverse the process to remove the bee beard, I assume.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. We actually use the same gear that we use to remove bees out of people's houses. I actually use that to siphon the bees off my face.
Okay. Don Shump, it was a fascinating conversation.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. Don Shump is founder and owner of the Philadelphia Bee Company. Don't forget, you can find the regional roundup at whyy.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Adam Staniszewski is our engineer today, our producer, Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you with us. Be well.